for us, couldn't you? You could help us get away.
I'm going to go now,
Will said, standing up. She held out her hand, a rueful smile, a shrug, and a nod as if to a skillful opponent who'd made a good move at the chessboard. That was what her body said. He found himself liking her because she was brave, and because she seemed like a more complicated and richer and deeper Lyra. He couldn't help but like her. So he shook her hand, finding it firm and cool and soft. She turned to the golden monkey, who had been sitting behind her all the time, and a look passed between them that Will couldn't interpret. Then she turned back with a smile.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Will.
He left the cave, knowing her eyes were following, and he didn't look back once. Amma was nowhere in sight. He walked back the way he'd come, keeping to the path until he heard the sound of the waterfall ahead.
She's lying,
Will said to Yorick Birnison 30 minutes later.
Of course she's lying. She'd lie even if it made things worse for herself, because she just loves lying too much to stop.
What is your plan, then?
Said the bear, who was basking in the sunlight, his belly flat down in a patch of snow among the rocks. Will walked up and down, wondering whether he could use the trick that had worked in Oxford. Use the knife to move into another world and then go to a spot right next to where Lyra lay, cut back through into this world, pull her through into safety, and then close up again. That was the obvious thing to do. Why did he hesitate?
Balthamos knew.
In his own angel shape, shimmering like a heat haze in the sunlight, he said,
You were foolish to go to her. All you want to do now is see the woman again.
Yorick uttered a deep, quiet growl. At first Will thought he was warning Balthamos, but then with a little shock of embarrassment he realized that the bear was agreeing with the angel. The two of them had taken little notice of each other until now. Their modes of being were so different, but they were of one mind about this, clearly. And Will scowled. But it was true. He had been captivated by Mrs. Coulter. All his thoughts referred to her. When he thought of Lyra, it was to wonder how like her mother she'd be when she grew up. If he thought of the church, it was to wonder how many of the priests and cardinals were under her spell. If he thought of his own dead father, it was to wonder whether he would have detested her or admired her. And if he thought of his own mother, he felt his heart grimace. He walked away from the bear and stood on a rock from which he could see across the whole valley. In the clear, cold air, he could hear the distant tock, tock, of someone chopping wood. He could hear a dull iron bell around the neck of a sheep. He could hear the rustling of the treetops far below. The tiniest crevices in the mountains at the horizon were clear and sharp to his eyes, as were the vultures wheeling over some near-dead creature many miles away. There was no doubt about it. Balthamos was right. The woman had cast a spell on him. It was pleasant and tempting to think about those beautiful eyes and the sweetness of that voice, and to recall the way her arms rose to push back that shining hair. With an effort he came back to his senses and heard another sound altogether, a far distant drone. He turned this way and that to locate it, and found it in the north, the very direction he and Yorick had come from.
Zeppelins,
said the bear's voice, startling Will, for he hadn't heard the great creature come near. Yorick stood beside him, looking in the same direction, and then reared up high, fully twice the height of Will, his gaze intent.
How many?
8 of them,
said Yorick after a minute, and then Will saw them too, little specks in a line.
Can you tell how long it will take them to get here?
They will be here not long after nightfall.
So we won't have very much darkness. That's a pity.
What is your plan?
To make an opening and take Lyra through into another world, and close it again before her mother follows. The girl has a drug to wake Lyra up, but she couldn't explain very clearly how to use it, so she'll have to come into the cave as well. I don't want to put her in danger, though. Maybe you could distract Mrs. Coulter while we do that.
The bear grunted and closed his eyes. Will looked around for the angel and saw his shape outlined in droplets of mist in the late afternoon light.
Balthamos! I'm going back into the forest now to find a safe place to make the first opening. I need you to keep watch for me and tell me the moment she comes near. Her, or that demon of hers.
Balthamos nodded and raised his wings to shake off the moisture. Then he soared up into the cold air and glided out over the valley, as Will began to search for a world where Lyra would be safe. In the creaking, thrumming double bulkhead of the leading Zeppelin, the dragonflies were hatching. The Lady Salmakia bent over the splitting cocoon of the electric blue one, easing the damp, filmy wings clear, taking care to let her face be the first thing that imprinted itself on the many faceted eyes, soothing the fine-stretched nerves, whispering its name to the brilliant creature, teaching it who it was. In a few minutes, the Chevalier Tialis would do the same to his. But for now, he was sending a message on the lodestone resonator, and his attention was fully occupied with the movement of the bow and his fingers. He transmitted,
"To Lord Roke, we are 3 hours from the estimated time of arrival at the valley. The Consistorial Court of Discipline intends to send a squad to the cave as soon as they land. It will divide into 2 units. The first unit will fight its way into the cave and kill the child, removing her head so as to prove her death. If possible, they will also capture the woman, though if that is impossible, they are to kill her. The second unit is to capture the boy alive. The remainder of the force will engage the gyropters of King Ogunwe. They estimate that the gyropters will arrive shortly after the Zeppelins. In accordance with your orders, the Lady Salmakia and I will shortly leave the Zeppelin and fly directly to the cave, where we shall try to defend the girl against the first unit, and hold them at bay until reinforcements arrive. We await your response."
The answer came almost immediately.
"To the Chevalier Tialis, in the light of your report, here is a change of plan. In order to prevent the enemy from killing the child, which would be the worst possible outcome, you and the Lady Salmakia are to cooperate with the boy. While he has the knife, he has the initiative. So if he opens another world and takes the girl into it, let him do so and follow them through. Stay by their side at all times."
The Chevalier Tialis replied,
"To Lord Roke, your message is heard and understood. The lady and I shall leave at once."
The little spy closed the resonator and gathered his equipment together.
"Tialis,"
came a whisper from the dark.
"It's hatching. You should come now."
He leapt up to the strut where his dragonfly had been struggling into the world, and eased it gently free of the broken cocoon. Stroking its great fierce head, he lifted the heavy antennae, still moist and curled, and let the creature taste the flavor of his skin until it was entirely under his command. Salmakia was fitting her dragonfly with the harness she carried everywhere. Spider silk reins, stirrups of titanium, a saddle of hummingbird skin. It was almost weightless. Tialis did the same with his, easing the straps around the insect's body, tightening, adjusting. It would wear the harness till it died. Then he quickly slung the pack over his shoulder and sliced through the oiled fabric of the Zeppelin's skin. Beside him, the lady had mounted her dragonfly, and now she urged it through the narrow gap into the hammering gusts. The long, frail wings trembled as she squeezed through, and then the joy of flight took over the creature, and it plunged into the wind. A few seconds later, Tialis joined her in the wild air, his mount eager to fight the swift-gathering dusk itself. The two of them whirled upwards in the icy currents, took a few moments to get their bearings, and set their course for the valley. Chapter 12. The Break.
Still as he fled, his eye was backward cast, as if his fear still followed him behind. Edmund Spenser.
As darkness fell, this was how things stood. In his adamant tower, Lord Asriel paced up and down. His attention was fixed on the little figure beside the lodestone resonator, and every other report had been diverted, every part of his mind was directed to the news that came to the small square block of stone under the lamplight. King Ogunwe sat in the cabin of his gyropter, swiftly working out a plan to counter the intentions of the consistorial court, which he just learned about from the Galavespian in his own aircraft. The navigator was scribbling some figures on a scrap of paper, which he handed to the pilot. The essential thing was speed. Getting their troops on the ground first would make all the difference. The gyropters were faster than Zeppelins, but they were still some way behind. In the Zeppelins of the consistorial court, the Swiss guard were attending to their kit. Their crossbows were deadly over 500 yards, and an archer could load and fire 15 bolts a minute. The spiral fins made of horn gave the bolt a spin and made the weapon as accurate as a rifle. It was also, of course, silent, which might be a great advantage. Mrs. Coulter lay awake in the entrance to the cave. The golden monkey was restless and frustrated. The bats had left the cave with the coming of darkness, and there was nothing to torment. He prowled about by Mrs. Coulter's sleeping bag, scratching with a little horny finger at the occasional glowflies that settled in the cave, and smearing their luminescence over the rock. Lyra lay hot and almost as restless, but deep, deep asleep, locked into oblivion by the draught her mother had forced down her only an hour before. There was a dream that had occupied her for a long time, and now it had returned, and little whimpers of pity and rage and lyratic resolution shook her breast and her throat, making Pantalaimon grind his polecat teeth in sympathy. Not far away, under the wind-tossed pines on the forest path, Will and Amma were making their way towards the cave. Will had tried to explain to Amma what he was going to do, but her demon could make no sense of it, and when he cut a window and showed her, she was so terrified that she nearly fainted. He had to move calmly and speak quietly in order to keep her nearby, because she refused to let him take the powder from her, or even to tell him how it was to be used. In the end, he had to say simply,
"Keep very quiet and follow me,"
and hope that she would. Yorick, in his armor, was somewhere close by, waiting to hold off the soldiers from the Zeppelin so as to give Will enough time to work. What neither of them knew was that Lord Asriel's force was also closing in. The wind from time to time brought a far distant clatter to Yorick's ears, but whereas he knew what Zeppelin engines sounded like, he had never heard a gyropter, and he could make nothing of it. Balthamos might have been able to tell them, but Will was troubled about him. Now that they'd found Lyra, the angel had begun to withdraw back into his grief. He was silent, distracted, and sullen, and that in turn made it harder to talk to Amma. As they paused on the path, Will said to the air,
"Balthamos, are you there?"
"Yes."
"Balthamos, please stay with me. Stay close and warn me of any danger. I need you."
"I haven't abandoned you yet."
That was the best Will could get out of him. Far above, in the buffeting mid-air, Tialis and Salmakia soared over the valley, trying to see down to the cave. The dragonflies would do exactly as they were told, but their bodies couldn't easily cope with cold, and besides they were tossed about dangerously in the wild wind. Their riders guided them low, among the shelter of the trees, and then flew from branch to branch, taking their bearings in the gathering dark. Will and Amma crept up in the windy moonlight to the closest point they could reach that was still out of sight of the cave mouth. It happened to be behind a heavy-leaved bush just off the path, and there he cut a window in the air. The only world he could find with the same conformation of ground was a bare, rocky place, where the moon glared down from a starry sky onto a bleached, bone-white ground, where little insects crawled and uttered their scraping, chittering sounds over a wide silence. Amma followed him through, fingers and thumbs moving furiously to protect her from the devils that must be haunting this ghastly place, and her demon, adapting at once, became a lizard and scampered over the rocks with quick feet. Will saw a problem. It was simply that the brilliant moonlight on the bone-coloured rocks would shine like a lantern once he opened the window in Mrs. Coulter's cave. He'd have to open it quickly, pull Lyra through, and close it again at once. They could wake her up in this world, where it was safer. He stopped on the dazzling slope and said to Amma,
"We must be very quick and completely silent. No noise, not even a whisper."
She understood, though she was frightened. The little packet of powder was in her breast pocket. She'd checked it a dozen times, and she and her demon had rehearsed the task so often that she was sure they could do it in total darkness. They climbed up on the bone-white rocks, Will measuring the distance carefully until he estimated that they would be well inside the cave. Then he took the knife and cut the smallest possible window he could see through, no larger than the circle he could make with thumb and forefinger. He put his eye to it quickly to keep the moonlight out, and looked through. There it all was. He'd calculated well. He could see the cave mouth ahead, the rocks dark against the night sky. He could see the shape of Mrs. Coulter asleep, with her golden demon beside her. He could even see the monkey's tail trailing negligently over the sleeping bag. Changing his angle and looking closer, he saw the rock behind which Lyra was lying. He couldn't see her, though. Was he too close? He shut that window, moved back a step or two, and opened again. She wasn't there.
"Listen,"
he said to Amma and her demon.
"The woman has moved her, and I can't see where she is. I'm going to have to go through and look around the cave to find her, and cut through as soon as I've done that. So stand back. Keep out of the way so I don't accidentally cut you when I come back. If I get stuck there for any reason, go back and wait by the other window where we came in.
We should both go through,
Amma said.
Because I know how to wake her, and you don't. And I know the cave better than you do, too.
Her face was stubborn, her lips pressed together, her fists clenched. Her lizard demon acquired a ruff and raised it slowly around his neck.
Oh, very well. But we go through quickly and in complete silence. And you do exactly what I say at once. You understand?
She nodded and patted her pocket yet again to check the medicine. Will made a small opening, low down, looked through and enlarged it swiftly, getting through in a moment on hands and knees. Amma was right behind him, and altogether the window was open for less than 10 seconds. They crouched on the cave floor behind a large rock, with the bird-formed Balthamos beside them, their eyes taking some moments to adjust from the moon-drenched brilliance of the other world. Inside the cave it was much darker, and much more full of sound, mostly the wind in the trees, but below that was another sound, too. It was the roar of a Zeppelin's engine, and it wasn't far away. With the knife in his right hand, Will balanced himself carefully and looked around. Amma was doing the same, and her owl-eyed demon was peering this way and that, but Lyra was not at this end of the cave. There was no doubt about it. Will raised his head over the rock and took a long, steady look down towards the entrance, where Mrs. Coulter and her demon lay deep in sleep. And then his heart sank. There lay Lyra, stretched out in the depths of her sleep, right next to Mrs. Coulter. Their outlines had merged in the darkness. No wonder he hadn't seen her. Will touched Amma's hand and pointed.
We'll just have to do it very carefully.
Something was happening outside. The roar of the Zeppelins was now much louder than the wind in the trees, and lights were moving about too, shining down through the branches from above. The quicker they got Lyra out, the better, and that meant darting down there now before Mrs. Coulter woke up, cutting through, pulling her to safety, and closing again. He whispered that to Amma. She nodded. Then, as he was about to move, Mrs. Coulter woke up. She stirred and said something, and instantly the golden monkey sprang to his feet. Will could see his silhouette in the cave mouth, crouching, attentive, and then Mrs. Coulter herself sat up, shading her eyes against the light outside. Will's left hand was tight around Amma's wrist. Mrs. Coulter got up, fully dressed, lithe, alert, not at all as if she'd just been asleep. Perhaps she'd been awake all the time. She and the golden monkey were crouching inside the cave mouth, watching and listening, as the light from the Zeppelin swung from side to side above the treetops and the engines roared, and shouts, male voices warning or calling orders, made it clear that they should move fast, very fast. Will squeezed Amma's wrist and darted forward, watching the ground in case he stumbled, running fast and low. Then he was at Lyra's side, and she was deep asleep, pantalaimon around her neck. And then Will held up the knife and felt carefully, and a second later there would have been an opening to pull Lyra through into safety. But he looked up. He looked at Mrs. Coulter. She had turned around silently, and the glare from the sky reflected off the damp cave wall hit her face, and for a moment it wasn't her face at all. It was his own mother's face, reproaching him, and his heart quailed from sorrow. And then as he thrust with the knife, his mind left the point, and with a wrench and a crack, the knife fell in pieces to the ground. It was broken. Now he couldn't cut his way out at all. He said to Amma,
"Wake her up. Do it now."
Then he stood up, ready to fight. He'd strangle that monkey first. He was tensed to meet its leap, and he found he still had the hilt of the knife in his hand. At least he could use it to hit with. But there was no attack, either from the golden monkey or from Mrs. Coulter. She simply moved a little to let the light from outside show the pistol in her hand. In doing so, she let some of the light shine on what Amma was doing. She was sprinkling a powder on Lyra's upper lip and watching as Lyra breathed in, helping it into her nostrils by using her own demon's tail as a brush. Will heard a change in the sounds from outside. There was another note now, as well as the roar of the Zeppelins. It sounded familiar, like an intrusion from his own world, and then he recognized the clatter of a helicopter. Then there was another and another, and more light swept across the ever-moving trees outside in a brilliant green scatter of radiance. Mrs. Coulter turned briefly as the new sound came to her, but too briefly for Will to jump and seize the gun. As for the monkey demon, he glared at Will without blinking, crouched ready to spring. Lyra was moving and murmuring. Will bent down and squeezed her hand, and the other demon nudged Pantalaimon, lifting his heavy head, whispering to him. Outside there was a shout, and a man fell out of the sky, to land with a sickening crash not 5 yards from the entrance to the cave. Mrs. Coulter didn't flinch. She looked at him coolly and turned back to Will. A moment later there came a crack of rifle fire from above, and a second after that a storm of shooting broke out, and the sky was full of explosions, of the crackle of flame, of bursts of gunfire. Lyra was struggling up into consciousness, gasping, sighing, moaning, pushing herself up only to fall back weakly. And Pantalaimon was yawning, stretching, snapping at the other demon, flopping clumsily to one side as his muscle failed to act. As for Will, he was searching the cave floor with the utmost care for the pieces of the broken knife. No time to wonder how it had happened, or whether it could be mended, but he was the knife-bearer, and he had to gather it up safely. As he found each piece, he lifted it carefully, every nerve in his body aware of his missing fingers, and slipped it into the sheath. He could see the pieces quite easily because the metal caught the gleam from outside, 7 of them, the smallest being the point itself. He picked them all up and then turned back to try and make sense of the fight outside. Somewhere above the trees, the Zeppelins were hovering and men were sliding down ropes, but the wind made it difficult for the pilots to hold the aircraft steady. Meanwhile, the first gyropters had arrived above the cliff. There was only room for them to land one at a time, and then the African riflemen had to make their way down the rock face. It was one of them who had been picked off by a lucky shot from the swaying Zeppelins. By this time, both sides had landed some troops. Some had been killed between the sky and the ground. Several more were wounded and lay on the cliff or among the trees. But neither force had yet reached the cave, and still the power inside it lay with Mrs. Coulter. Will said above the noise,
"What are you going to do?"
"Hold you captive."
"What? As hostages? Why should they take any notice of that? They want to kill us all anyway."
"One force does, certainly, but I'm not sure about the other. We must hope the Africans win."
She sounded happy, and in the glare from outside, Will saw her face full of joy and life and energy.
"You broke the knife."
"No, I didn't. I wanted it whole so we could get away. You were the one who broke it."
Lyra's voice came urgently.
"Will? Is that Will?"
"Lyra."
He knelt quickly beside her. Amma was helping her sit up.
"What's happening? Where are we? Oh, Will, I had this dream."
"We're in a cave. Don't move too fast. You'll get dizzy. Just take it carefully. Find your strength. You've been asleep for days and days."
Her eyes were still heavy and she was racked by deep yawns, but she was desperate to be awake, and he helped her up, putting her arm over his shoulder and taking much of her weight. Amma watched timidly, for now that the strange girl was awake, she was nervous of her. Will breathed in the scent of Lyra's sleepy body with a happy satisfaction. She was here. She was real. They sat on a rock. Lyra held his hand and rubbed her eyes.
"What's happening, Will?"
"Amma here got some powder to wake you up."
Lyra turned to the girl, seeing her for the first time, and put her hand on Amma's shoulder in thanks.
"I got here as soon as I could. But some soldiers did too. I don't know who they are. We'll get out as soon as we can."
Outside, the noise and confusion were reaching a height. One of the gyropters had taken a fusillade from a Zeppelin's machine gun while the riflemen were jumping out on the clifftop, and it burst into flames, not only killing the crew but also preventing the remaining gyropters from landing. Another Zeppelin, meanwhile, had found a clear space further down the valley, and the crossbowmen who disembarked from it were now running up the path to reinforce those already in action. Mrs. Coulter was following as much as she could see from the cave mouth, and now she raised her pistol, supporting it with both hands, and took careful aim before firing. Will saw the flash from the muzzle, but heard nothing over the explosions and gunfire from outside. "If she does that again," he thought, "I'll rush and knock her over." And he turned to whisper that to Balthamos. But the angel was nowhere near. Instead, Will saw with dismay, he was cowering against the wall of the cave, back in his angel form, trembling and whimpering.
"Balthamos! Come on, they can't hurt you! And you have to help us! You can fight, you know that. You're not a coward, and we need you."
But before the angel could reply, something else happened. Mrs. Coulter cried out and reached down to her ankle, and simultaneously the golden monkey snatched at something in midair with a snarl of glee. A voice, a woman's voice, but somehow minute, came from the thing in the monkey's paw.
"Tialis! Oh, Tialis!"
It was a tiny woman, no bigger than Lyra's hand, and the monkey was already pulling and pulling at one of her arms so that she cried out in pain. Amar knew he wouldn't stop till he'd torn it off, but Will leapt forward as he saw the pistol fall from Mrs. Coulter's hand. And he caught the gun. But then Mrs. Coulter fell still, and Will became aware of a strange stalemate. The golden monkey and Mrs. Coulter were both utterly motionless. Her face was distorted with pain and fury, but she dared not move, because standing on her shoulder was a tiny man, with his heel pressed against her neck, his hands entwined in her hair. And Will, through his astonishment, saw on that heel a glistening horny spur and knew what had caused her to cry out a moment before. He must have stung her ankle. But the little man couldn't hurt Mrs. Coulter any more because of the danger his partner was in at the hands of the monkey. And the monkey couldn't harm her in case the little man dug his poison spur into Mrs. Coulter's jugular vein. None of them could move. Breathing deeply and swallowing hard to govern the pain, Mrs. Coulter turned her tear-dashed eyes to Will.
So, Master Will, what do you think we should do now?
Chapter 13 Tialis and Salmakia.
Frowning, frowning night, o'er this desert bright, let thy moon arise while I close my eyes. William Blake.
Holding the heavy gun, Will swept his hand sideways and knocked the golden monkey off his perch, stunning him so that Mrs. Coulter groaned aloud, and the monkey's paw relaxed enough to let the tiny woman struggle free. In a moment she leapt up to the rocks, and the man sprang away from Mrs. Coulter, both of them moving as quickly as grasshoppers. The three children had no time to be astonished. The man was concerned. He felt his companion's shoulder and arm tenderly, and embraced her swiftly before calling to Will.
You, boy, have you got the knife?
Of course I have,
said Will. If they didn't know it was broken, he wasn't going to tell them.
You and the girl will have to follow us. Who is the other child?
Amar, from the village.
Tell her to return there. Move now, before the Swiss come.
Will didn't hesitate. Whatever these two intended, he and Lyra could still get away through the window he'd opened behind a bush on the path below. So he helped her up and watched curiously as the two small figures leapt on... What? Birds? No, dragonflies, as large as seagulls which had been waiting in the darkness. Then they darted forward to the cave mouth where Mrs. Coulter lay. She was half stunned with pain and drowsy from the Chevalier's sting, but she reached up as they went past her and cried,
Lyra! Lyra, my daughter! My dear one, Lyra! Don't go! Don't go!
Lyra looked down at her, anguished, but then she stepped over her mother's body and loosened Mrs. Coulter's feeble clutch from her ankle. The woman was sobbing now. Will saw the tears glistening on her cheeks. Crouching just beside the cave mouth, the three children waited until there was a brief pause in the shooting, and then followed the dragonflies as they darted down the path. The light had changed. As well as the cold anbaric gleam from the Zeppelin's floodlights, there was the leaping orange of flames. Will looked back once. In the glare, Mrs. Coulter's face was a mask of tragic passion, and her demon clung piteously to her as she knelt and held out her arms, crying,
Lyra! Lyra, my love! My heart's treasure, my little child, my only one. Oh, Lyra! Lyra, don't go! Don't leave me! My darling daughter, you're tearing my heart!
And a great and furious sob shook Lyra herself, for after all, Mrs. Coulter was the only mother she would ever have, and Will saw a cascade of tears run down the girl's cheeks. But he had to be ruthless. He pulled at Lyra's hand, and as the dragonfly rider darted close to his head, urging them to hurry, he led her at a crouching run down the path and away from the cave. In Will's left hand, bleeding again from the blow he'd landed on the monkey, was Mrs. Coulter's pistol.
Make for the top of the cliff,
said the dragonfly rider,
and give yourself up to the Africans. They're your best hope.
Mindful of those sharp spurs, Will said nothing, though he hadn't the least intention of obeying. There was only one place he was making for, and that was the window behind the bush. So he kept his head low and ran fast, and Lyra and Amar ran behind him.
Halt!
There was a man, three men, blocking the path ahead, uniformed. White men with crossbows and snarling wolf-dog demons, the Swiss Guard.
Yorick!
Cried Will at once.
Yorick Birnison!
He could hear the bear crashing and snarling not far away, and hear the screams and cries of the soldiers unlucky enough to meet him. But someone else came from nowhere to help them. Balthamos, in a blur of desperation, hurled himself between the children and the soldiers. The men fell back, amazed, as this apparition shimmered into being in front of them. But they were trained warriors, and a moment later their demons leapt at the angel, savage teeth flashing white in the gloom, and Balthamos flinched. He cried out in fear and shame, and shrank back. Then he sprang upwards, beating his wings hard. Will watched in dismay as the figure of his guide and friend soared up to vanish out of sight among the treetops. Lyra was following it all with still dazed eyes. It had taken no more than 2 or 3 seconds, but it was enough for the Swiss to regroup, and now their leader was raising his crossbow, and Will had no choice. He swung up the pistol and clamped his right hand to the butt and pulled the trigger, and the blast shook his bones, but the bullet found the man's heart. The soldier fell back as if he'd been kicked by a horse. Simultaneously, the two little spies launched themselves at the other two, leaping from the dragonflies at their victims before Will could blink. The woman found a neck, the man a wrist, and each made a quick backward stab with a heel. A choking, anguished gasp, and the two Swiss died, their demons vanishing in mid-howl. Will leapt over the bodies, and Lyra went with him, running hard and fast with Pantalaimon racing wildcat formed at their heels. "Where's Amma?" Will thought, and he saw her in the same moment dodging down a different path. "Now she'll be safe," he thought, and a second later he saw the pale gleam of the window deep behind the bushes. He seized Lyra's arm and pulled her towards it. Their faces were scratched, their clothes were snagged, their ankles twisted on roots and rocks, but they found the window and tumbled through into the other world, onto the bone-white rocks under the glaring moon, where only the scraping of the insects broke the immense silence. And the first thing Will did was to hold his stomach and retch, heaving and heaving with a mortal horror. That was 2 men now that he killed, not to mention the youth in the Tower of the Angels. Will did not want this. His body revolted at what his instinct had made him do, and the result was a dry, sour, agonizing spell of kneeling and vomiting until his stomach and his heart were empty. Lyra watched helpless nearby, nursing Pan, rocking him against her breast. Will finally recovered a little and looked around, and at once he saw that they weren't alone in this world, because the little spies were there, too, with their packs laid on the ground nearby. Their dragonflies were skimming over the rocks, snapping up moths. A man was massaging the shoulder of the woman, and both of them looked at the children sternly. Their eyes were so bright and their features so distinct that there was no doubt about their feelings, and Will knew they were a formidable pair, whoever they were. He said to Lyra,
"The alethiometer's in my rucksack. There."
"Oh, Will, I did so hope you'd find it. Whatever happened? Did you find your father? Oh, and my dream, Will. It's too much to believe what we've got to do. Oh, I don't even think of it. And it's safe. You brought it all this way safe for me."
The words tumbled out of her so urgently that even she didn't expect answers. She turned the alethiometer over and over, her fingers stroking the heavy gold and the smooth crystal and the knurled wheels they knew so well. Will thought, "It'll tell us how to mend the knife." But he said first,
"Are you all right? Are you hungry or thirsty?"
"I don't know. Yeah, but not too much. Anyway..."
"We should move away from this window, just in case they find it and come through."
"Yes, that's true,"
she said, and they moved up the slope, Will carrying his rucksack and Lyra happily carrying the little bag she kept the alethiometer in. Out of the corner of his eye, Will saw the 2 small spies following, but they kept their distance and made no threat. Over the brow of the rise there was a ledge of rock that offered a narrow shelter, and they sat beneath it, having carefully checked it for snakes, and shared some dried fruit and some water from Will's bottle.
"The knife's broken. I don't know how it happened. Mrs. Coulter did something, or said something, and I thought of my mother, and that made the knife twist, or catch, or... I don't know what happened. But we're stuck till we can get it mended. I didn't want those 2 little people to know, because while they think I can still use it, I've got the upper hand. I thought you could ask the alethiometer, maybe, and..."
Yeah, I will."
She had the golden instrument out in a moment, and moved into the moonlight so she could see the dial clearly. Looping back the hair behind her ears, just as Will had seen her mother do, she began to turn the wheels in the old familiar way, and Pantalaimon, mouse-formed now, sat on her knee. She had hardly started before she gave a little gasp of excitement, and she looked up at Will with shining eyes as the needle swung. But it hadn't finished yet, and she looked back, frowning, until the instrument fell still. She put it away, saying,
"Yorick, Is he nearby, Will? I thought I heard you call him, but then I thought I was just wishing. Is he really?
Yes. Could he mend the knife? Is that what the alethiometer said?
Oh, he can do anything with metal, Will. Not only armor, he can make little delicate things as well.
She told him about the small tin box Yorick had made for her to shut the spyfly in.
But where is he?
Close by. He would have come when I called, but obviously he was fighting. And Balthamus! Oh, he must have been so frightened.
Who?
He explained briefly, feeling his cheeks warm with the shame that the angel must be feeling.
But I'll tell you more about him later. It's so strange. He told me so many things, and I think I understand them too.
He ran his hands through his hair and rubbed his eyes.
You got to tell me everything. Everything you did since she caught me. Oh, Will, you ain't still bleeding. Your poor hand.
No. My father cured it. I just opened it up when I hit the golden monkey. But it's better now. He gave me some ointment that he'd made.
You found your father?
That's right. On the mountain, that night.
He let her clean his wound and put on some fresh ointment from the little horn box while he told her some of what had happened. The fight with the stranger. The revelation that came to them both a second before the witch's arrow struck home. His meeting with the angels. His journey to the cave. And his meeting with Yorick.
All that happening, and I was asleep. Do you know, I think she was kind to me, Will. I think she was. I don't think she ever wanted to hurt me. She did such bad things, but...
She rubbed her eyes.
Oh, but my dream, Will. I can't tell you how strange it was. It was like when I read the alethiometer. All that clearness and understanding going so deep, you can't see the bottom, but clear all the way down. It was... Remember I told you about my friend Roger, and how the gobblers caught him, and I tried to rescue him, and it went wrong, and Lord Asriel killed him. Well, I saw him. In my dream, I saw him again. Only he was dead. He was a ghost, and he was, like, beckoning to me, calling to me. Only I couldn't hear. He didn't want me to be dead. It wasn't that. He wanted to speak to me. And it was me that took him there, to Svalbard, where he got killed. It was my fault he was dead. And I thought back to when we used to play in Jordan College, Roger and me, on the roof, all through the town, in the markets, and by the river and down the clay beds, me and Roger and all the others. And I went to Bolvanger to fetch him safe home. Only I made it worse. And if I don't say sorry, it'll all be no good, just a huge waste of time. I got to do that, you see, Will. I got to go down into the land of the dead and find him, and say sorry. I don't care what happens after that. Then we can... I can... Well, it doesn't matter after that.
This place where the dead are, is it a world like this one, like mine, or yours, or any of the others? Is it a world I could get to with the knife?
She looked at him, struck by the idea.
You could ask. Do it now. Ask where it is and how we get there.
She bent over the alethiometer and her fingers moved swiftly. A minute later she had the answer.
Yes, but it's a strange place, Will. So strange. Could we really do that? Could we really go to the land of the dead? But what part of us does that? Because demons fade away when we die. I've seen them. And our bodies, well, they just stay in the grave and decay, don't they?
Then there must be a third part. A different part.
You know, I think that must be true. Because I can think about my body and I can think about my demon. So there must be another part to do the thinking.
Yes. And that's the ghost.
Lyra's eyes blazed.
Maybe we could get Roger's ghost out. Maybe we could rescue him.
Maybe. We could try.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll go together. That's exactly what we'll do.
But if they didn't get the knife mended, Will thought, they'd be able to do nothing at all. As soon as his head cleared and his stomach felt calmer, he sat up and called to the little spies. They were busy with some minute apparatus nearby.
Who are you? And whose side are you on?
The man finished what he was doing and shut a wooden box like a violin case no longer than a walnut. The woman spoke first.
We are Galavespian, I am the Lady Salmakia, and my companion is the Chevalier Tialis. We are spies for Lord Asriel.
She was standing on a rock 3 or 4 paces away from Will and Lyra, distinct and brilliant in the moonlight. Her little voice was perfectly clear and low, her expression confident. She wore a loose skirt of some silver material and a sleeveless top of green, and her spurred feet were bare like the man's. His costume was similarly coloured, but his sleeves were long and his wide trousers reached to mid-calf. Both of them looked strong, capable, ruthless and proud.
What world do you come from? I never seen people like you before.
Our world has the same problems as yours,
said Tialis.
We are outlaws. Our leader, Lord Roke, heard of Lord Asriel's revolt and pledged our support.
And what did you want to do with me?
To take you to your father,
said the Lady Salmakia.
Lord Asriel sent a force under King Ogunwe to rescue you and the boy and bring you both to his fortress. We are here to help.
Ah, but suppose I don't want to go to my father? Suppose I don't trust him?
I'm sorry to hear that, but those are our orders, to take you to him.
Lyra couldn't help it. She laughed out loud at the notion of these tiny people making her do anything. But it was a mistake. Moving suddenly, the woman seized Pantalaimon, and holding his mouse body in a fierce grip, she touched the tip of a spur to his leg. Lyra gasped. It was like the shock when the men at Bolvanger had seized him. No one should touch someone else's demon. It was a violation. But then she saw that Will had swept up the man in his right hand, holding him tightly around the leg so he couldn't use his spurs, and was holding him high.
Stalemate again. Put the Chevalier down, boy.
Let go of Lyra's demon first. I'm not in the mood to argue.
Lyra saw with a cold thrill that Will was perfectly ready to dash the Gallivespian's head against the rock, and both little people knew it. Salmakia lifted her foot away from Pantalaimon's leg, and at once he fought free of her grasp and changed into a wildcat, hissing ferociously, fur on end, tail lashing. His bared teeth were a hand's breadth from the lady's face, and she gazed at him with perfect composure. After a moment he turned and fled to Lyra's breast, ermine-shaped, and Will carefully placed Tialis back on the rock beside his partner.
You should show some respect,
the Chevalier said to Lyra.
You are a thoughtless, insolent child, and several brave men have died this evening in order to make you safe. You'd do better to act politely.
Yes, I'm sorry, I will. Honest.
As for you...
As for me, I'm not going to be spoken to like that, so don't try. Respect goes two ways. Now listen carefully. You are not in charge here. We are. If you want to stay and help, then you do as we say. Otherwise, go back to Lord Asriel now. There's no arguing about it.
Lyra could see the pair of them bristling, but Tialis was looking at Will's hand, which was on the sheath at his belt, and she knew he was thinking that while Will had the knife, he was stronger than they were. At all costs, they mustn't know it was broken then.
Very well. We shall help you, because that's the task we've been given. But you must let us know what you intend to do.
That's fair. I'll tell you. We're going back into Lyra's world as soon as we've rested, and we're going to find a friend of ours, a bear. He's not far away.
The bear with the armor? Very well. We saw him fight. We'll help you do that. But then you must come with us to Lord Asriel.
Yes,
said Lyra, lying earnestly.
Oh, yes. We'll do that then, all right.
Pantalaimon was calmer now and curious, so she let him climb to her shoulder and change. He became a dragonfly, as big as the two that were skimming through the air as they spoke, and darted up to join them.
That poison,
Lyra said, turning back to the Gallivespians.
In your spurs, I mean. Is it deadly? Because you stung my mother, Mrs. Coulter, didn't you? Will she die?
It was only a light sting,
said Tialis.
A full dose would have killed her, yes, but a small scratch will make her weak and drowsy for half a day or so.
And full of maddening pain, he knew. But he didn't tell her that.
I need to talk to Lyra in private. We're just going to move away for a minute.
With that knife, you can cut through from one world to another. Isn't that so?
Don't you trust me?
No.
All right. I'll leave it here, then. If I haven't got it, I can't use it.
He unbuckled the sheath and laid it on the rock, and then he and Lyra walked away and sat where they could see the Gallivespians. Tialis was looking closely at the knife handle, but he wasn't touching it.
We'll just have to put up with them. As soon as the knife's mended, we'll escape.
They're so quick, Will. And they wouldn't care. They'd kill you.
I just hope Yorick can mend it. I hadn't realized how much we need it.
He will.
She was watching Pantalaimon as he skimmed and darted through the air, snapping up tiny moths like the other dragonflies. He couldn't go as far as they could, but he was just as fast, and even more brightly patterned. She raised her hand and he settled on it, his long, transparent wings vibrating.
Do you think we can trust them while we sleep?
Will said.
Yes. They're fierce, but I think they're honest.
They went back to the rock, and Will said to the Gallivespians,
I'm going to sleep now. We'll move on in the morning.
The Chevalier nodded, and Will curled up at once and fell asleep. Lyra sat down beside him with Pantalaimon cat-formed and warm in her lap. How lucky Will was that she was awake now to look after him. He was truly fearless, and she admired that beyond measure. But he wasn't good at lying and betraying and cheating, which all came to her as naturally as breathing. When she thought of that, she felt warm and virtuous, because she did it for Will, never for herself. She had intended to look at the alethiometer again, but to her deep surprise she found herself as weary as if she'd been awake all that time instead of unconscious. And she lay down close by and closed her eyes, just for a brief nap, as she assured herself before she fell asleep. Chapter 14. Know What It Is.
Labor without joy is base. Labor without sorrow is base. Sorrow without labor is base. Joy without labor is base. John Ruskin.
Will and Lyra slept through the night and woke up when the sun struck their eyelids. They actually awoke within seconds of each other with the same thought, but when they looked around, the Chevalier Tialis was calmly on guard close by.
The force of the consistorial court has retreated. Mrs. Coulter is in the hands of King Ogunwe, and on her way to Lord Asriel.
How do you know?
Said Will, sitting up stiffly.
Have you been back through the window?
No. We talk through the lodestone resonator. I reported our conversation,
Tialis said to Lyra,
to my commander, Lord Roke, and he has agreed that we should go with you to the bear, and that once you have seen him, you will come with us. So, we are allies, and we shall help you as much as we can.
Good. Then let's eat together. Do you eat our food?
Thank you, yes,
said the lady. Will took out his last few dried peaches and the stale flat loaf of rye bread, which was all he had left, and shared it among them, though of course the spies did not take much.
As for water, there doesn't seem to be any around here on this world. We'll have to wait till we go back through before we can have a drink.
Then we better do that soon,
said Lyra. First, though, she took out the alethiometer and asked if there was still any danger in the valley. No, came the answer. All the soldiers have gone, and the villagers are in their homes. So they prepared to leave. The window looked strange in the dazzling air of the desert, giving on to the deep shaded bush, a square of thick green vegetation hanging in the air like a painting. The Gallivespians wanted to look at it, and were astounded to see how it was just not there from the back, and how it only sprang into being when you came round from the side.
I'll have to close it once we're through,
Will said. Lyra tried to pinch the edges together after they went through, but her fingers couldn't find it at all. Nor could the spies, despite the fineness of their hands. Only Will could feel exactly where the edges were, and he did it cleanly and quickly.
How many worlds can you enter with the knife?
As many as there are. No one would ever have time to find out.
He swung his rucksack up and led the way along the forest path. The dragonflies relished the fresh, moist air and darted like needles through the shafts of sunlight. The movement of the trees above was less violent, and the air was cool and tranquil, so it was all the more shocking to see the twisted wreckage of a gyropter suspended among the branches, with the body of its African pilot tangled in his seatbelt, half out of the door, and to find the charred remains of the zeppelin a little farther up, soot-black strips of cloth, blackened struts and pipework, broken glass, and then the bodies. Three men burned to cinders, their limbs contorted and drawn up as if they were still threatening to fight. And they were only the ones who had fallen near the path. There were other bodies and more wreckage on the cliff above and among the trees further down. Shocked and silenced, the two children moved through the carnage, while the spies on their dragonflies looked around more coolly, accustomed to battle, noting how it had gone and who had lost most. When they reached the top of the valley, where the trees thinned out and the rainbow waterfalls began, they stopped to drink deeply of the ice-cold water.
I hope that little girl's all right. We'd never have got you away if she hadn't woken you up. She went to a holy man to get that powder specially.
She is all right, 'cause I asked the alethiometer last night. She thinks we're devils, though. She's afraid of us. She probably wishes she'd never got mixed up in it. But she's safe all right.
They climbed up beside the waterfalls and refilled Will's canteen before striking off across the plateau towards the ridge where the alethiometer told Lyra that Yorick had gone. And then there came a day of long, hard walking. No trouble for Will, but a torment to Lyra, whose limbs were weakened and softened after her long sleep. But she would sooner have her tongue torn out than confess how bad she felt. Limping, tight-lipped, trembling, she kept pace with Will and said nothing. Only when they sat down at noon did she allow herself so much as a whimper, and then only when Will had gone apart to relieve himself. The Lady Salmakia said,
"Rest. There is no disgrace in being weary."
"But I don't want to let Will down. I don't want him to think I'm weak and holding him back."
"That's the last thing he thinks."
"You don't know. You don't know him any more than you know me."
"I know impertinence when I hear it. Do as I tell you now and rest. Save your energy for the walking."
Lyra felt mutinous, but the lady's glittering spurs were very clear in the sunlight, so she said nothing. The lady's companion, the Chevalier, was opening the case of the lodestone resonator, and, curiosity overcoming resentment, Lyra watched to see what he did. The instrument looked like a short length of pencil made of dull grey-black stone, resting on a stand of wood, and the Chevalier swept a tiny bow like a violinist's across the end, while he pressed his fingers at various points along the surface. The places weren't marked, so he seemed to be touching it at random, but from the intensity of his expression and the certain fluency of his movements, Lyra knew it was as skillful and demanding a process as her own reading of the alethiometer. After several minutes, the spy put the bow away and took up a pair of headphones, the earpieces no larger than Lyra's little fingernail, and wrapped one end of the wire tightly around a peg in the end of the stone, leading the rest along to another peg at the other end, and wrapping it around that. By manipulating the two pegs and the tension on the wire between them, he could obviously hear a response to his own message.
"How does that work?"
she said when he'd finished. Tialis looked at her as if to judge whether she was genuinely interested, and then said,
"Your scientists, what do you call them, experimental theologians, would know of something called quantum entanglement. It means that two particles can exist that only have properties in common, so that whatever happens to one happens to the other at the same moment, no matter how far apart they are. Well, in our world, there is a way of taking a common lodestone and entangling all its particles and then splitting it in two so that both parts resonate together. The counterpart to this is with Lord Roke, our commander. When I play on this one with my bow, the other one reproduces the sounds exactly. And so we communicate."
He put everything away and said something to the lady. She joined him and they went a little apart, talking too quietly for Lyra to hear, though Pantalaimon became an owl and turned his great ears in their direction. Presently Will came back and then they moved on, more slowly as the day went by and the track got steeper and the snow line nearer. They rested once more at the head of a rocky valley, because even Will could tell that Lyra was nearly finished. She was limping badly and her face was grey.
"Let me see your feet,"
he said to her,
"because if they're blistered, I'll put some ointment on."
They were, badly, and she let him rub in the blood moss salve, closing her eyes and gritting her teeth. Meanwhile, the Chevalier was busy, and after a few minutes he put his lodestone away and said,
"I have told Lord Roke of our position, and they are sending a gyropter to bring us away as soon as you have spoken to your friend."
Will nodded. Lyra took no notice. Presently she sat up wearily and pulled on her socks and shoes, and they set off once more. Another hour, and most of the valley was in shadow, and Will was wondering whether they would find any shelter before night fell. But then Lyra gave a cry of relief and joy.
"Yorick! Yorick!"
She had seen him before Will had. The Bear King was some way off still, his white coat indistinct against a patch of snow, but when Lyra's voice echoed out he turned his head, raised it to sniff, and bounded down the mountainside towards them. Ignoring Will, he let Lyra clasp his neck and bury her face in his fur, growling so deep that Will felt it through his feet. But Lyra felt it as pleasure and forgot her blisters and her weariness in a moment.
Oh, Yorick, my dear, I'm so glad to see you. I never thought I'd ever see you again, after that time on Svalbard. And all the things that have happened. Is Mr. Scoresby safe? How's your kingdom? Are you all alone here?
The little spies had vanished. At all events, there seemed to be only the three of them now on the darkening mountainside, the boy and the girl and the great white bear. As if she had never wanted to be anywhere else, Lyra climbed up as Yorick offered his back, and rode proud and happy as her dear friend carried her up the last stretch of the way to his cave. Will, preoccupied, didn't listen as Lyra talked to Yorick, though he did hear a cry of dismay at one point and heard her say,
"Mr. Scoresby! Oh, no! Oh, it's too cruel! Really dead. You're sure, Yorick?"
"The witch told me he set out to find the man called Grumman."
Will listened more closely now, for Baruch and Balthamos had told him some of this.
"What happened? Who killed him?"
"He died fighting. He kept a whole company of Muscovites at bay while the man escaped. I found his body. He died bravely. I shall avenge him."
Lyra was weeping freely, and Will didn't know what to say, for it was his father whom this unknown man had died to save. And Lyra and the bear had both known and loved Lee Scoresby, and he had not. Soon Yorick turned aside and made for the entrance to a cave, very dark against the snow. Will didn't know where the spies were, but he was perfectly sure they were nearby. He wanted to speak quietly to Lyra, but not till he could see the Gallivespians and know he wasn't being overheard. He laid his rucksack in the cave mouth and sat down wearily. Behind him the bear was kindling a fire, and Lyra watched, curious despite her sorrow. Yorick held a small rock of some sort of ironstone in his left forepaw, and struck it no more than three or four times on a similar one on the floor. Each time a scatter of sparks burst out and went exactly where Yorick directed them, into a heap of shredded twigs and dried grass. Very soon that was ablaze, and Yorick calmly placed one log and then another and another until the fire was burning strongly. The children welcomed it, because the air was very cold now. And then came something even better, a haunch of something that might have been goat. Yorick ate his meat raw, of course, but he spitted its joint on a sharp stick and laid it to roast across the fire for the two of them.
"Is it easy, hunting up in these mountains, Yorick?"
"No, my people can't live here. I was wrong, but luckily so, since I found you. What are your plans now?"
Will looked around the cave. They were sitting close to the fire, and the firelight threw warm yellows and oranges on the Bear King's fur. Will could see no sign of the spies, but there was nothing for it. He had to ask.
"King Yorick, my knife is broken."
Then he looked past the bear and said,
"No, wait."
He was pointing at the wall.
"If you're listening, come out and do it honestly. Don't spy on us."
Lyra and Yorick Birnison turned to see who he was talking to. The little man came out of the shadow and stood calmly in the light on a ledge higher than the children's heads. Yorick growled.
"You haven't asked Yorick Birnison for permission to enter his cave. And he is a king and you're just a spy. You should show more respect."
Lyra loved hearing that. She looked at Will with pleasure and saw him fierce and contemptuous. But the Chevalier's expression as he looked at Will was displeased.
"We have been truthful with you. It was dishonorable to deceive us."
Will stood up. His demon, Lyra thought, would have the form of a tigress, and she shrank back from the anger she imagined the great animal to show.
"If we deceived you, it was necessary. Would you have agreed to come here if you knew the knife was broken? Of course you wouldn't. You'd have used your venom to make us unconscious, and then you'd have called for help and had us kidnapped and taken to Lord Asriel. So we had to trick you, Tialis, and you'll just have to put up with it."
"Who is this?"
"Spies, sent by Lord Asriel. They helped us escape yesterday, but if they're on our side, they shouldn't hide and eavesdrop on us. And if they do, they're the last people who should talk about dishonor."
The spy's glare was so ferocious that he looked ready to take on Yorick himself, never mind the unarmed Will. But Tialis was in the wrong, and he knew it. All he could do was bow and apologize.
"Your Majesty,"
he said to Yorick, who growled at once. The Chevalier's eyes flashed hatred at Will, and defiance and warning at Lyra, and a cold and wary respect at Yorick. The clarity of his features made all these expressions vivid and bright, as if a light shone on him. Beside him, the Lady Salmakia was emerging from the shadow, and, ignoring the children completely, she made a curtsy to the bear.
"Forgive us,"
she said to Yorick.
"The habit of concealment is hard to break, and my companion, the Chevalier Tialis, and I, the Lady Salmakia, have been among our enemies for so long.